The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here, and thank you all for tuning in. And today we have a great show with you again today with Dr. Eric Seathouse. I think this is his 15th book we're going to be talking about, Bigelow Aerospace, Colonizing Space, One Module at a Time. We'll get to that in just a minute. For those of you who would like to call and talk to Eric, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, so thespaceshow.com. If you check it out, there's a very detailed newsletter there in the middle of the homepage. You can't miss it. It's uploaded fresh every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. It has all of the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it's the only place where we have a future events section. And sometimes we have to change our programming in the week. The guest has a change of plans, or we have a change of plans. So do check the website newsletter. That's where we post those changes. And if you want to stay current, make sure a certain program is going to happen at a specific time. Check it just to be sure, because if it is changed, you will see it first right there. Everything we do is archived on the Space Show, excuse me, and you can find our archives on our website or on our blog, http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And on the blog, you can also post comments that the guests often see and respond to, as well as other listeners. So check them both out. And then, of course, we are podcasting, and you can pick up our podcast on iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, and a host of other places on the net. And the RSS URL, if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, is on our website newsletter, as well as our email newsletter. If you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to get a hold of me, and I'll respond to you real quickly. There's a store on our website, upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear. We are in the holiday season, so do check it out. The most important button there is to support the Space Show. And remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are dependent upon your gifts and contributions to keep the Space Show on the air. And we appreciate your support very much. We are now in the phase of the year where we do our annual fundraising. Our email annual letter of need, as they say, will be sent out either later today or tomorrow. And we appreciate your support, and thank you very much for helping to keep the Space Show going. If you have any questions, check us out at onegiantleapfoundation.org, or just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember, we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, go ahead and check out their website, www.swfound.org. And remember, they do sponsor our webinar series. Just as a reminder, the Great SLS Debate with Rick Boozer and SLS John Hunt has been archived both on the website and the blog and for podcasting. And the video is on our Vimeo channel for the Space Show, which is also on our website newsletter. So check it out and let us know. Post your comments on that debate on the blog for that particular show. Excuse me, as I said earlier, Eric Seathouse is back with us today with his 15th book, Bigelow Aerospace, Colonizing Space One Module at a Time. It's Springer Praxis book. Eric has been with us all of, on all of those books. And he is Norwegian-Canadian. He's a suborbital astronaut. His ambition has been to work in space. He was a finalist for Canadian astronauts with the Canadian Space Agency, one of the final 30 candidates. Let's see, that was in, I guess, 2009. He runs marathons, or he did. I think you've retired from running marathons, right?
Still do triathlons.
You should have been in space, because with your physical fitness, that'd have been a lot of fun.
I needed to get a United States passport. That's my problem.
I understand you can buy them, but maybe that's not the way you want to go.
Well, I did have an offer a few years ago. This was back in the 90s. One of my friends is a headhunter in San Francisco, and one of his friends is a lawyer. And as a side job, he organized passports or arranged marriages for people who wanted to be a United States citizen.
But you're already married.
Yeah, that was a problem.
Well, I guess you can divorce your wife and marry someone down here and then divorce her after a while and bring your other wife back down. Where there's a will, Eric, there's a way.
Well, there's a limit as well.
Well, you come to the States for conferences. I know that's not the same thing, but...
In Hawaii last week for the Next Giant Leap conference.
Yeah, tell us about that. And by the way, listeners, his full bio is on the website. We're already talking with Eric, and it's much more fun to talk with him than read about him. But you can read about all of his accomplishments and what he's done in his other 14 books. His bio is on the website in many, many places, but it's on this week's newsletter as well. How was the Hawaiian conference? What did you think of it?
It was really well put together, because it wasn't just people from the space industry. It was other people, such as investors, people who actually explained to scientists and engineers what a business plan is and what you should look for in a business plan, and what you should put in and what you shouldn't put in. And so, also there were business leaders as well, so that it sort of gives the space people a perspective on looking outside their bubble. Because often when you're a scientist and engineer, you know how to do what you're going to do, and you know where you're going to go, but actually getting there in terms of getting the financing in place is probably the hardest part. So we had people like Shackleton Energy, Jim Caravalla, he was there, and we had obviously Buzz Aldrin. He was the keynote speaker on the Tuesday, so it was obviously interesting meeting him. But yeah, it was just a very well put together conference, different from many other conferences in that it included a lot of diverse people with a lot of backgrounds in different fields.
Was it well attended?
It was. It was close to 100 people there, which for Hawaii was difficult to get to in this fiscal environment. So, it was well attended.
I was actually going to go, as you know, and then I needed to do some follow-up medical stuff from that cardiac ablation I had in April, and I chose not to delay the medical stuff, so I didn't go. But I was all planning to go and was actually looking forward to it. I would have enjoyed a week in Hawaii.
Can't argue with that.
Next year, as they say, right?
That's it.
You spoke at the conference, correct?
Yeah, I was on one of the plenary panels.
What was your topic?
Well, I spoke about Big Little Aerospace, because that's probably the most affordable way to get back to the moon is to use his expandable module. So I actually spoke about a little bit about Bigelow, because not everybody knows much about his background, and then I explained about the technology, because a lot of people still have questions about the technology. So I just explained how rugged it is and how suited it would be to establishing a lunar base, because that is going to be the next destination, is going to be the lunar surface.
Was there a lot of interest in the topic?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people from the space background, especially the engineers, they understood and they knew and had heard about the Bigelow technology, so they were familiar with it. Some people who were surprised at just how rugged the technology is, and also how affordable it is, because, again, getting back to the moon is going to be a question of money, and you obviously want to use technology that's on the table, that's the TRL-7 or above, and that's what this technology is.
Did you get to do any sightseeing around any of the analog sites or anything like that in Hawaii?
Well, I missed that. There was no. I didn't get the email on that. That was just Saturday morning. So it was just one off visit. So hopefully, I'll do that next time.
So you would recommend this conference next year for people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a snowballing of interest now in going back to the moon. The Duma in Russia requested, I think, $16 billion for setting up a Russian lunar base. The Chinese have always advertised the fact they're going to be setting up a base. Shackleton Energy is waiting for a decision on the 29th of March next year for their funding. And if they get their funding, they're going to be setting up a base. But everybody's going back to the moon. Even the Africans are going to the moon. They're sending a robotic probe there sometime in the next few years.
Well,
all the emphasis is on the moon. So finally, people have come around to the fact that we cannot get to Mars using chemical propulsion. So the next best thing is to go to the moon, test out the technology there, and wait for...
Wait a minute, Eric. Not everybody. Mars One is going on chemical propulsion. Inspiration Mars, if it ever works, goes to Mars on chemical propulsion. So not everybody, and even Bob Zubrin says you don't need nuclear propulsion to go to Mars.
Well, he cherry picks the research.
Well, I'm not arguing that, but Mars One isn't cherry picking the research.
I'll correct myself. So almost everybody then.
Yeah. Okay, good. Almost. Well, Doug doesn't know it, who calls in all the time from Southern California. But when the new Congress takes effect, I'm going to somehow propose Doug to be their space counselor, since he's got Moon written all over him, and he's Mr. Moon advocate for the space show, just like SLS John. Promotes SLS. We're going to call, instead of Dr. Doug from Southern California, he's now going to be Lunar Doug, and I'm going to try to get him to be a consultant to the new Congress on going back to the moon, since he eats, breathes, and sleeps the moon, and it's also replaced his hemoglobin. But the NASA doesn't seem to have caught on to go back to the moon. And,
well, that doesn't really matter that much, because it's commercial enterprises, and so I think, depending on how much traction the Russians get and how much traction the Chinese get, I think once, if either the Russians or the Chinese go back to the moon first, then it will be a government enterprise. But until then, I think it will be the commercial companies leading the way. So, for example, if Shackleton, like you say, Jim reckons they've got a good business case and they've got a good chance of getting that money, if Shackleton gets that money, then they'll be back on the moon in 2023, 2024.
With what? What rock? How are they going to get there?
They're planning on using. That's a little bit vague on that, but
That seems to be. I think they're going to remember those rockets we had when we were kids, and we'd fill them with water and then put them on a little hand pump, and we pump them up in the backyard, and they'd go up 100 or 200 feet. Did you have those growing up?
Well, I saw them. Yeah.
So maybe that's what they're going to use for going back to the moon. Well, I mean, I hate to be flip about it.
Fly a Falcon 5 and take up extra fuel and. Create something on orbit to get to the moon. That's one way to go.
Not only will I see it when I believe these guys getting the money, not just Shackleton, but all of them, when I see them doing something. Listen, I'd like to see someone actually really and truly win the X Prize, okay?
Yeah, and
that's much lower. That's a much lower bar.
It is, and there's a lot of talk about that, and that's, like I said, that's got a lot of traction as well. So it really needs to be a parallel work with the government and the commercial enterprises. But like I say, the way NASA is now, NASA has to divide up its money between science projects and man projects and all sorts of other projects, whereas the other agencies, they're not restricted by that. I mean, China, if it wants, can just...
Well, no, they're totalitarian governments.
Yeah,
they can do what they
pour
want.
Pour all its money into manned spaceflight, just like the Russians can, if they want.
Well, we could do it if we wanted to. We just make other choices. You know.
Well, like I say, they're bound by Congress, these four-year cycles. And again, that's another thing.
Yeah, but Congress could make a different choice if they were so inclined. But there's pressures, and we don't need to go into that. We know why they don't do it.
Yeah.
Let's go to your book, because I really enjoyed reading it. I have a copy of it that you sent me. In my hands, and it's a great book. And Bigelow is the real thing. I'm not skeptical about Bigelow at all. I'm a big supporter of Bigelow. Is this book, did you get any assistance? Is it sort of an authorized Bigelow book, or did you have to pull it together on your own?
No, I had to pull it together, just like the SpaceX book. I mean, I must have phoned them 40 times, and you get through to the secretary, and she's very polite and says, look, we'll pass on your requested Mr. Bigelow the next time he's in, and weeks go by, and then I see phone again.
Nothing happens, yeah.
It's the same response, and yeah, I mean, even the cover image, I had to go to Bill Ingalls at NASA and said, look, that's actually a big story of Boeing, and I asked Boeing, could you give me permission to use this image for my book? And they were very helpful, and I said yes. So that image is a Boeing image that you see on the front of the book.
Right. Was there anyone from Bigelow at the Hawaiian conference?
No. Jim, who's the organizer, he did try and get hold of Bigelow, but they weren't successful. So the ideal opportunity, it would be an ideal opportunity for Bigelow to test one of the systems in Hawaii, because you could test the life support system in a rugged environment. And like I say, he wants to go back to the moon with his surface inflatable, so we're going to try and pitch that to him for next year.
Let's talk about your book. Obviously, you're very high and positive on Bigelow Aerospace, but were there any surprises that you stumbled upon in researching and in writing the book? I mean, you know, they are in the press. They're not like Bezos and Blue Origin. We know a lot about them. They're public. Bob goes to conferences and talks at AIAA conferences and other conferences, which is where I've met him many times. And it's not everything being done in secrecy. Did you find surprises? Was something really grabbed your attention that you didn't know about?
Yeah, the history. So this concept of inflatable technology goes back a lot longer than I thought. When I was doing the research, it goes back all the way to the 50s. So the technology that's actually used in the inflatable today goes back to the Batalloons, which are these big balloons that they send up into the edge of space in 1958, called the ECHO program. And then even in the Apollo program in 61 and 62, they were looking at building an inflatable space station because they thought the mission architecture would include stop off at a orbiting space station, which would be inflatable. And so they kept that alive all the way through to 62, 63, before the budget cuts came in, and then that meant they couldn't afford the space station. And then they sort of kept it on the back burner. They were still developing it for the new space station, the one that we have right now. So initially there was going to be an inflatable module on the International Space Station. But in 96, when the budget for the space station was shown to be $5 billion over what it was anticipated to cost, then they actually cut the inflatable project out of the equation, and that's where Bigelow came in. So this has a long legacy. It goes back nearly over 50 years, this inflatable technology, and it's very, very rugged, and it can do the job.
So Bigelow, he has taken this technology from NASA, correct?
Yeah, so what he did, Bigelow always wanted to explore space on his own terms. He never wanted to work for NASA. He never wanted to be an astronaut. He just wanted to have a space company. And the way to do that was to get a lot of money. His dad was a real estate agent, so Bigelow decided to do the same. Built up Budget Suites of America, made hundreds of millions of dollars, and in 1999 he established Bigelow Aerospace, and then he needed to find a way to do what he wanted to do, which was to, make a presence in space. And so, first of all, he looked at some existing commercial companies, but he didn't like their business plans. And then he came across an article in Smithsonian Magazine, which was about these inflatable modules. And he bought the patents, 8 of them, and approached some engineers from the Johnson Space Center and NASA, and also Bill Schneider. William Schneider is the father of the TranTabs. And went to work, and that's the story.
And does he own the technology, or did he have to like lease it or something from NASA?
As far as I understand, he bought the patents from NASA. There were 8 patents, and he bought them.
And he's about to send a module to the space station next year, right?
That's right. The Beam. It's called Beam is the Bigelow expandable activity module. So it's not going to add that much. It's not one of the biggest modules that Bigelow manufactures, but it's going to add about 2% to the volume of the International Space Station. So that goes up first half of next year. It's going to be attached to Node 3, I think, the Tranquility module. It's going to be attached there for 2 years, and every few weeks or so, astronauts are going to go in just to check the integrity of the module, pressurization, and so on and so forth. But the Genesis modules that have been orbiting for 8 years now, 7 and 8 years, they've lost very, very little pressure. I mean, they're still going around and around the Earth, doing what they were designed to do.
Is the beam module going to, is it actually going to do anything, or is it just going to be entered into to see how it holds up?
Yeah, it's just a test of technology. That's all it is, really.
And how does that get up there? Do you know which flight it's scheduled to go up on?
I think it's the CRS flight, number 8, which is in May, I think. I'll have to check on that.
In May?
Yeah. That might have slipped by now. I think it was CRS flight, number 8.
At one point, you know, Bigelow wanted to have his own private astronaut corps for his own private space station. Did you come across that in researching your book?
Well, he employed two astronauts last year, Kenneth Ham and I've forgotten the other guy's name. So basically those two guys, I think, are going to be responsible for training the sovereign customers. So Bigelow has 7 agreements with sovereign customers, and those sovereign customers will be astronauts who are going to be trained by Bigelow to fly on the BA-330. So as soon as SpaceX and as soon as Boeing are operational, then Bigelow is going to use either of those or both to fly sovereign customers to the BA-330. So that could start as early as 2017.
Joe is in Boston. He sent you in an email, and he says, Eric, do you know how he intends to do station keeping and maneuvering on the BA-330 as a private space station?
Yeah, they have the BA-330 can be docked using docking nodes, and then they also have propulsion nodes as well, so they can be fitted with propulsion nodes. Obviously, the same principle as the International Space Station. The International Space Station has to boost its orbit regularly, otherwise it would just fall out of the sky. So Bigelow uses the same principle, and that's all that they will do. They'll just use attached propulsion node and boost its orbit as required.
Does it have rockets attached for this, or does it have to have something come up and dock to it?
I think the BA-330 can be launched in its entirety with a docking node and a propulsion node. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it can.
And he takes a ride on any way he can get up there, whether it's an Atlas or a SpaceX Falcon, or, I mean, he's truly launch vehicle agnostic, correct?
Yeah, he has agreements with Boeing and SpaceX. I spoke with an Atlas V engineer. He's the guy who actually sells these, Atlas V. And he said the Atlas V would work fine. It's man-rated except for one component. I forgot what the component is, but the Atlas V is another option as well, all ready to go.
Years ago when there was an AIAA meeting in San Jose, California, so we're really going back in years, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, he did a press conference with George Sowers of ULA, in which they announced a partnership to use Atlas to, do his things. That's where I met George as well. And, we've been waiting ever since. That there's a lot of waiting in the space world, isn't there?
Yeah, you have to be patient.
Was there anything in doing your research for Bigelow that was disappointing or maybe surprised you in sort of a downer type of way?
Well, it's just the detail. So when you read the technology and when you read the patents and the way they tested the technology, it sounds good, it sounds solid. But I was actually talking about this with Buzz Aldrin, because Buzz Aldrin has met Bigelow several times. And obviously we were talking about the moon, and Bigelow's patent for getting on the moon is to actually assemble the lunar base in orbit around the moon and then just to land the entire base. And Buzz Aldrin was skeptical about that, and he actually explained that he had a long discussion with Bigelow about this, and Bigelow wasn't really able to explain how they were going to do this, because that sounds rather ambitious to me. So that detail is missing. I can understand how they can assemble the habitat in orbit, in lunar orbit, but I don't see, and I've read nothing about how they could actually land that entire habitat on the moon using the technology they have right now. So it's little details like that. The technology for getting the Transat up into space, the BA-330, that's solid. The way they deploy it, I mean, that's all solid. That's all doable. The lunar aspect of it, I'm not sure how they can do the final stage, which is to land the base.
Did you talk to any Bigelow Aerospace employees? And if you did you talk to any SpaceX employees when you were writing that book? And can you do a compare and contrast?
Well, you can't. I mean, I know colleagues who work for both, and I asked, would it be possible to, you know, just sort of describe a day in the life of a SpaceX engineer or a day in the life of a Bigelow engineer? And they said, yeah, sure, but I just have to clear with my manager. And of course, the next email was, sorry, we can't do this.
Sorry,
they,
you can't.
They just won't let you to do it.
So they won't do it off the cuff with you?
No, it's like dealing with the NSA sometimes. Yeah.
From your observations and insights, is there much difference in a day in the life?
I think most people find it easier to work for SpaceX than they do for Bigelow. That's all I can say, really, from the feedback I got from people I know who've worked for both companies.
Easier to be at SpaceX.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic that Bigelow's going to meet the vast majority of his goals and objectives with space, or do you think that in any way he's bitten off too much?
No, he hasn't put a foot wrong. I mean, he's in a waiting game right now. He's waiting for SpaceX and Boeing to be operational. So if they were operational now, chances are he'd be flying sovereign customers up to his transat. So the transat part, the orbiting inflatable modules, the beams, the BA-330s, whichever one he flies, that's solid. I think that will happen inevitably, whether it's 2017 or 2018 or 19. That's going to happen. He will be flying sovereign customers. That's his business plan. It's a solid business plan. He will make money from that. As far as the lunar base is concerned, like I say, the technology is there. It's just the landing. Like I say, I'm not sure how they're going to land that base on the moon. So I think that's going to be a little bit further down the line when that's going to happen.
This is from Carl, and Carl says that he's in Chicago. And he says, many people on David's show talk about a change in the next administration in the United States leading to a much more robust space program and a much more robust effort and an open effort to return to the moon rather than relying on the privates and the entrepreneurs. Is there anything in your research that has indicated to you that there will be such a change for the better in space policy and returning to the moon after the next U.S. presidential election?
I really don't see it. They have to sell the mission, and they're not selling it right now. Like, I think one of the guys at the conference recalled a meeting with James Cameron. James Cameron, the film director, he was at NASA during Constellation in 2006.
Right.
And he said, one of the quotes, I can't remember the quote word for word, but it was along the lines of, you need a new story and you need to tell it better, basically. Because, you know, scientists and engineers, they know the technology, they know how we're going to get there, but actually selling it to the public is something different. People have very short attention spans. So, for example, Virgin Galactic, we're talking about tourists in space, three words. People understand that. Tourists in space, it's easy to understand, comprehend. And they get that. Once you start talking about sustainable development in space and asteroid missions, that just goes straight over people's heads. And so basically what you have to do is actually sell the mission, wherever that is, whether it's going back to the moon or whether it's going to Mars or whether it's capturing an asteroid. And I really don't think the asteroid mission has really captured the public imagination.
No, it's not very popular, that's for sure.
So it's really a PR deal. Really, they have to come up with a mission and sell it in a way that captures people's imagination and also the imagination of the politicians who actually fund this. And I think the way the funding is going with regards to the Space Launch System and Orion and everything else is precious little funding for returning to the moon. And I think the only catalyst for that would be if the Russians get that money approved, so if the Duma approved that $16, $17 billion for the Russians going back to the moon, and if the Chinese start making headway to the moon, I think that's the only way that would change. And right now, the Chinese are delayed in their development because of the Long March launcher has been delayed by a couple of years. So their space plans have been pushed to the right. Initially, they were planning on going to the moon by 2023, 2024. So that's going to be now 25, 26. And the Russians, again, they're probably behind the Chinese on that. So you're looking at, you know, the end of the 2020s. So unless nothing's probably going to happen until the Russians or the Chinese land on the moon, and then the light will go on for the politicians thinking, okay, this is not good that we have the Russians or the Chinese on the moon, because then it comes down to mineral rights. And who owns the moon? Are you even allowed to own past the moon? And all of the other issues come to the fore.
So you think it'll take a kind of a Cold War-like space race to get us going again?
Well, I think it was Gorbachev last week. He actually mentioned that we're actually in a cool war right now. But then we're in a situation now where we have more and more commercial activity. So I think it doesn't necessarily have to be the government that gets us back to the moon. It could be people like Bigelow, it could be Shackleton, it could be a combination or a series of companies, or a consortium of companies, that actually get us back there.
Okay, so you're not looking for any big seed political changes one way or another, because of whoever wins elections over the near term with the United States?
Not unless there's a surprising increase in NASA's budget, no.
In terms of selling the moon, many people who, especially who listen to this show, because this show has a business component to it, think that these projects have to be commercial, meaning that at some point they generate a profit and make money. Is that enough for selling the moon to go back on? We can make money, we can have new businesses, a new addition to our economy. Is that sufficient, or was Cameron and or others talking about a different kind of story?
No, that's part of it, but part of it is prestige. I mean, that's why the Russians are going there, that's why the Chinese are going there. It's about prestige, part of it. So some missions will be flagged in footprints. I mean, it's just like climbing Everest. Just because Hillary climbed Everest in 1953 didn't stop a lot of other countries climbing Everest. It'll be the same with the moon. I mean, that's why Bigelow has these MOUs with all his sovereign customers. All these countries don't have manned space programs. I mean, the United Arab Emirates, they don't have a manned space program. Singapore doesn't have a manned space program. They're looking to put their astronauts into space commercially, and so that agreement that Bigelow has with his sovereign customers may extend to landing their astronauts on the moon as well. So there may be some flags and footprints missions there. And then in terms of the business plan, then we've heard talk about the Chinese going back to the moon to mine helium-3. There's supposed to be a lot of helium-3 on the moon. If they can get it back to the surface of the Earth profitably, we don't know. Or even if they can get it back to low Earth orbit, we don't know. And then you're looking at Shackleton's business model. They're looking at mining water and volatiles, and maybe sending them back to low Earth orbit where they can be used for satellite resurfacing and satellite boosting operations, for example. So that's their business model. If you talk to a business person or an investor and you ask them about these business models, 9 times out of 10 they'll shake their head because they don't like the word sustainable. A lot of these business models include the word sustainable, and the word sustainable to an investor means stagnant, and no investor wants to invest in a business that is stagnant. So this is one of the things that came out of the conference, was the business model in a lot of these business enterprises when it comes to the moon are not very robust.
No, they still seem to be lacking, right?
Yeah, in terms of their engineering, in terms of TRL, in terms of the technology, it's very, very solid. But in terms of the business plan, it's less so.
So Perry sent in an email from Kansas City. David, I'm still at work, so I'm using email today. Russia has been reported as having said that they intend to cancel their participation in the space station in 2020 and go at their own with unlaunched modules that they intend to use on their own station. Plus, they may take some of their modules off the ISS to use on their own station. My understanding is that without the Russian control center, that works in conjunction with NASA's control center, the whole future of the space station may be up for grabs or void or headed for a crashdown in one of the oceans. I'm curious, do you think that if the Bigelow has a success with their orbiting module later this year, that the United States could see Bigelow as a possible source for a new U.S. space station that could be put up very easily and quite inexpensive compared to the ISS, if in fact the ISS has an early 2020 range demise?
Well, they've approved the ISS life to 2024.
But not Russia, Eric. Russia has not. They said they're pulling out in 2020.
Well, there's a lot of blustering along when it comes to the Russians, so we don't have to always believe what they say. But
well, that may be true, but that they announced that last week.
Yeah. So basically, when you start getting to the 2020, 2024 time frame, then you're looking at possibly another tenant or another business or another space station in space, and that could well be Bigelow. So people have been talking about whether we need to replace the space station. If that's the case, I don't think it will be a government space station. I think it will be a commercial one along the lines of Bigelow. And it would be very affordable, these BA-330 modules. A lot less expensive than the government modules that we used on the International Space Station. So we're not talking about a $100 billion space station. We're talking about one that is maybe one order of magnitude less in terms of cost. So I think the next space station would be a commercial space station. I think it would be a Bigelow space station in terms of an American space station. And then obviously the Chinese, they're looking to fly their Tiangong space station, I think, in 2 or 3 years' time. And that's going to be manned off and on, so it's not going to be permanently manned initially. But eventually, the Tiangong will be a permanently manned space station. So by the time of 2020, 21, I envisage that you have definitely the Chinese space station, probably a small Bigelow station, and possibly a Russian one. But I still think the Russians will stay with the ISS.
Well, what will we bribe them with to get them to stay with it? Maybe that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that goes, and it'd be interesting to see what the Duma do with the request of funding for the lunar base.
Have you ever physically seen and touched one of the Bigelow modules?
No. I'm a Canadian citizen, so they wouldn't allow me.
They wouldn't allow you in. So,
no.
Several years ago, there was a new space conference, except back then it was still just Space Frontier Foundation, and they were having them at the, I can't remember the name of the hotel. I think it was the Flamingo Hotel, which was just a block off the Strip in July. Okay, it was a dreadful time to be in Las Vegas because it was 120 outside. But I guess the rooms and the convention facilities were at a great rate. You know, who the hell wants to go there at 120 degrees? But anyway, they arranged a tour for us to go out to Bigelow. So this is a long time ago because now it's all new space conferences and they're all down in Silicon Valley and they've been that way for 5 or 6 years. So we're going back in time, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. I don't remember. And he had replicas of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 that you could actually walk up to and touch, and they had portholes in them, and you know you could look inside them, although you couldn't see very much. But you could see exactly what they look like. You could handle the material. So I think inflatable is probably not a good word to use because they were inflated for us, and you know they were scale models, so you know it wasn't the same size as Genesis, and Genesis is a scale model anyway. But I think you could have fired a Magnum 45 into it from a foot away, and I think it would have bounced off. This stuff, this material, is really, really hard. It is. So to say it's inflatable, most people conjure up some kind of a balloon, right?
The JSC people who actually designed this, they prefer the term expandable.
Well, okay, expandable. Because it is really, really hard. I mean, I think you could wear it for body armor And it would protect you against an IED or just about anything. We were really surprised at just how tough this material was. And then they have a pool out in the back, this big swimming pool. It looks like a swimming pool, but it's not a swimming pool. And what they do is they fill it with water, and then they put the inflatable in it, and they keep inflating it until it bursts so they can see what its burst strength is. And then it burst against the water so that, the debris doesn't go flying everywhere and all that kind of stuff. And a pretty cool facility. And we all were very, very impressed with the inflatables. There we go, the expandables. And the material that this is made of. I mean, it was an eye-opener. And I assume that if it got hit by some orbiting item in space, that it would be extremely durable, easily as durable as the ISS.
No, it's actually more durable and much stronger than ISS. So you're absolutely right. I mean, they've tested this to destruction. They actually fired projectiles at it at 7 kilometers per second. So a rifle bullet travels at about 1 kilometer per second. So they've actually recreated conditions it would face in space. So these micrometeorites would be traveling about that speed. And it stands up, because what happens, you have all these layers, and you have these inner liners, a bladder, you have these structural restraint layers, you have a micrometeorite orbital debris protection system, then a thermal layer, then another protective layer on top of that, and then more inner liners to protect from that. And what happens when a projectile hits, it just dissipates layer by layer, so it doesn't really even reach the fourth or fifth layer, because of the energy dissipation that's created by having all these layers and bladders. And so they're basically ablative energy-absorbing layers. And so basically you really can't penetrate more than layer 3 or layer 4. And then that the inflation pressure as well. So for the standard for the International Space Station modules is to inflate them to 2 times operating pressure, so that's a factor of safety of 1, or 2, sorry. For the bigger ones, for the modules, they inflated those modules to 4 times operating pressure. So they have a factor of safety of 2 times what the International Space Station modules are. So they're absolutely incredibly, incredibly tough. So if you have an option of staying in an International Space Station module or a Bigelow module, I think most astronauts would probably want to stay in a Bigelow module.
Yeah, if you've ever handled a fire hose with water pouring through it, these expandables are, at least to the touch, far harder and firmer than a fire hose. I mean, this is incredible material. And then we went into his command structure and control room, which I'm assuming he's probably remodeled several times over the years to keep it modern. Very, very sophisticated. And we could see both Genesis on the tracking board, doing their orbits and stuff like that and how they communicated with him. And he has a very, very impressive operation. And as I said, this was 8 or 9 years ago, and I can only imagine how it's evolved today. And I think he's on the right track, and I truly believe his company is going to be very, very successful.
Yeah, like I say, you have to be doing something like to get a personal fortune of $700 million.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it'd be great to go visit a Bigelow space station and for 3 or 4 laps around the Earth or something like that, or to spend a couple of days in it. I think that would be a fantastic voyage.
Yeah, that's his business model. Like I said, he's a businessman. He wants to make money, and he's crunched the numbers, and the flights, you can't really do much with those because those are fixed prices. I mean, on SpaceX, on the Dragon, it's going to cost $23 million a seat. On CST-100, it's going to cost about $36 million a seat. We can't do much about those, but in terms of the stay times on the station, then you're looking at $5 or $6 million for a week. And if you look at the latest space tourist, Sarah Brightman, I think she paid $15 million for her flight when she goes up next year. So it's a lot cheaper to visit Bigelow than it is to visit the ISS if you're commercial.
Absolutely, and you probably get the same views, and you probably actually have more fun on the Bigelow. I would think that you get to see and do more.
Yeah, more space, yeah. These things are huge.
We need to take a break, but you got another email. I'll take this email before we go to the break. Michael Listener says, The Russians are bluster. They won't leave the ISS. They can't afford to build their own. So, Michael, I suggest you listen to Bachelor Hotel Mars with us, with Anatoly Zak, on Wednesday, because Anatoly's updating us on that. And they may or may not be bluster. I don't know. But I often think people who make affirmative statements often end up eating those statements a year or two down the road. So, caution. I don't know whether they're BSing the world and doing this for rhetoric, or trying to pressure the United States to lift sanctions to keep them in the space station, or what their alternative goals are. But it'll be fun hearing Anatoly Zak on Wednesday give the Russian perspective to this. And, you know, we'll see what happens between now and a couple of years from now, when a decision would have to be firmly made to do that. Eric, you ready for our break?
Yep.
Okay, listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. And the toll-free number for those of you free to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And others who are listening at work or don't access the phone for whatever reason, you can continue sending us email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The book, again, which I totally recommend, Bigelow Aerospace, Colonizing Space One Module at a Time, by Eric Seedhouse, published by Springer Praxis. Back in 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to part two of our Monday Space Show program. Our guest today is Eric Seedhouse, and his book that we're talking about, Bigelow Aerospace, Colonizing Space One Module at a Time, the toll-free line for those that want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You do have an email that just came in from, from Tony up in the Pacific Northwest. And he says, Vectron, that's the material that Bigelow uses, is as strong as Kevlar, and it has better cryogenic temperature, hard crease mechanical properties than Kevlar. So folding it up for a year on a trip to Mars won't be a problem. But Bigelow expandables need cheap, reusable rockets. Hold on, got to get the rest of the damn message here. Okay, Mr. Bigelow said in 2003 that he wasn't going to launch any cargo until it cost $500 a pound to LEO. My question for you, Eric, is, do you know how much Mr. B is going to pay SpaceX to launch their expandables in 2016?
Well, I know the Space Act agreement that Bigelow signed in January 2013 with NASA for the beam was $17.8 million. So that's the only number that I know with regard to the Space Act agreement. So, like I said, it's going up on CRS flight number 8. Whether Bigelow is paying the bulk of that or whether NASA and Bigelow are sharing that, I don't know. I don't know the details of that. I just know that the FAA was valued at $17.8 million.
Well, and that was over all of the flights that he was going to take up for NASA. So
yeah.
you divide it by the number of flights, and you get the approximate price per flight.
Yes, it's not a big module. It's not his biggest module. It's a pretty small module because it's just a test module. So it doesn't have to be...
It's not a full-size space station by any means or anything like that.
No, and he's very frugal when it comes to launching. I mean, when he launches Genesis modules, he used an old ICBM, an SS-18, also known as the Satan, and he went to Russia, and he launched from Russia because he was fed up with dealing with ITAR in the United States. He absolutely hates him to test ITAR.
Yeah, and then he said Russia raised their prices, and he said, to hell with them, I'm not doing it anymore with them.
That's right.
So he really has the economics as a good businessman down for pat. You have a caller on hold. We'll get to the moon, Eric, don't worry. Where's my thing? Caller. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Welcome to the show, please.
Hi, Eric. This is Doug, and I've got a question for you. Have you ever heard of a Bigelow-like inflatable greenhouse? Anything about that?
For the moon, you mean?
Yes.
Well, just what I've seen on the model that he has. I mean, most of what I wrote about in the book was the surface endoscopical inflatable module, which is the core of the base. But no, I haven't really. I mean, I've come across the greenhouse, but I like I say, it's getting hold of the details. I usually go through the AIAA reports, and I wasn't able to find anything there. So I wasn't really, because I wasn't able to find very much about it, I didn't include it in the book.
Specifically in regards to Bigelow?
Well, the greenhouse, yeah.
Because there, for example, there's Lunar Greenhouse at University of Arizona, but I was asking specifically about Bigelow. Have you ever seen any models with, like, plants growing inside?
No.
Yeah. Too bad.
He has tested the life support system. I mean, he has agreements with Andrew Space and other companies for the life support system, and he has put people in the inflatables. That was at the end of last year. So he actually had students. He had to put a call out for students to volunteer their time to go and spend time in the module to test the life support system. So they've tested the life support system of the modules, but not for the lunar base modules.
Okay. What about the specific location on the moon? Have you ever heard of whether he'd be polar or equatorial?
No, they haven't. Like I say, as far as I know, they haven't specified where they're going to land. I know that some of the commercial companies like Shackleton, obviously they're going to land in Shackleton Crater, and then they're pros and against for polar locations versus equatorial locations. It just depends on what you're mining. So, for example, the Chinese, they're going to be mining helium-3, so they'll go where the helium-3 deposits are. Shackleton, they're going to go where the water is. We don't know where the Russians are going to go. And again, I don't know what Bigelow's plans are for that.
So is it even clear what Bigelow would do on the moon? I mean, is he wanting for there to be resources utilized there, or would it be simply a sort of an international, what would you call it, international sort of research base where people can, you know, various countries could land on the moon and then stay there while doing geology exploration around the area?
Well, we don't know. I mean, some of the missions may be flags and footprints, so he has these MOUs with sovereign customers. But having said that, he wants to anchor permanent commercial facilities, so he wants to have property rights. And that's why he's lobbied the American government and the UN to file for an amendment to the Outer Space Treaty so that it allows private individuals like himself to own sections of the moon, because that's what he wants to do. From his business, as far as his business plan is concerned, he wants to mine the moon. But that's not necessarily going to be the only missions. They're going to be Bigelow missions because, again, with these MOUs that he has with the sovereign customers.
Right, right. I sent you earlier today some pictures. Did you get those?
I'm not actually not in front of my computer right now. I didn't get them, and David just resent them.
Oh, okay.
He sent you a reply and told you he didn't get the pictures. I don't know if you got it.
Yeah, I thought I texted the pictures, but I didn't confirm it. Nonetheless, they're, you know, as been discussed earlier in the show today, the thickness of the BA modules are pretty thick, and I think they're specifically thick in order to deal with orbital debris in LEO. But if you were to land those modules on the moon, it's not obvious to me that you need that thickness if you're going to be covering the modules with sort of end-to-end sandbags that he has in his models. And so it seems like a whole lot of mass to transport from LEO all the way to the lunar surface if you're just going to cover and provide your own shielding. Also evidence that maybe there's a better way to do it with thinner walls is NASA has developed the Moon-Mars inflatable modules, which are just very thin. They are basically sort of Kevlar. There's like maybe four layers and then a restraining sort of straps. And the pictures of that are, you know, way thinner than the Bigelow modules. Do you have any idea if the lunar modules that Bigelow wants to do, would they be normal BA-330 type stuff with all that mass, or would it be sort of a scaled down version in terms of the thickness of the walls?
Well, the volume is about the same. So the volume, what the module is that he intends to use for the lunar base is different from the BA-330 because you couldn't land the BA-330 on the moon. So what they did, they modified it and they came up with what's called a surface endoskeletal inflatable module.
Huh.
So this is still a rigid core from which a structural membrane is inflated and basically then expanded into habitable space. So it's basically the same sort of design as the BA-330, but a lunar version of it. So it still has the same structural concepts. I mean, it has the layers and everything else. And one of the reasons for the layers, and again, this comes down to radiation protection. So one of the reasons for all the layers is that you have this water wall, and that's another technology that's incorporated into these modules, is a water wall to actually protect astronauts from radiation. So whether you want to use regolith, or whether you want to use water walls, or whether you want to use both, that has to be incorporated into the structure, and that's what Bigelow has done. So yes, these surface endoskeletal inflatable modules, they can be covered with regolith, but they also have another means of protecting the crew from radiation. And in terms of landing it, I made this point earlier in the program, is that that's the one aspect technically that I wasn't sure of, because there's a lot of information about the technology of the habitat and the module and all the layers and everything else. But in terms of landing the entire base, because that's the pattern. Bigelow actually filed a patent in terms of how to land an entire base from lunar orbit onto the surface of the moon. And that's the one that I wasn't exactly sure of how it worked, and Buzz Aldrin wasn't very sure of how that might work either. So in terms of landing them individually, that would work. And that's one thing we discussed at the lunar conference, was that rather than have Bigelow assemble his lunar base in orbit and land it on the moon in its entirety, how about testing it on the surface? And so we invited Bigelow to bring one of his modules over to Hawaii, packed, and then see if astronauts could actually pull the module out of its covering and actually put the module up on the surface in Hawaii. So that's one thing we're going to try and do next year. So I think if he wanted to establish a lunar base right now, I think the best way to go would be actually to land the modules individually and actually have astronauts deploy them.
Yeah, I would actually like to see a large inflatable landed on the lunar surface and then it be pulled out from the lander using either telerobots or actually winching it out, and then just putting the slightest amount of air inside and have it unfold itself. And I think that would be a pretty straightforward way of accomplishing that goal.
And Bigelow isn't the only technology in the inflatable technology business. So, for example, Shackleton, from what I gather, they're not using Bigelow inflatables. They're using a Canadian company. And if we're talking about Canadian companies, there's only one company in Canada that builds inflatable modules, and that's Thin Red Line in British Columbia, because they built the Genesis modules. So there's also the Thin Red Line, and then there's also Alenia in Italy, because they build these, and that may be the one that you were talking about, because the Alenia modules are a little bit slimmer than the Bigelow ones. A little bit thinner.
You know, let me just say I'm getting a bit concerned that in terms of the first permanent lunar base, it strikes me as though, when China sends its taikonauts to the moon, it seems like it'd be just like way too tempting to not send six sorties to six different parts of the moon, and do the same thing that America did, but 50 or so years later. But rather for it to try to do something more advanced, and that is to go to the same location and to establish a permanent lunar base, and hence, really leapfrog ahead. To me, it's just too tempting for a country that, wants to be seen as a leader in technology, that's just sitting there ready to be done. And it seems to me as though if the first term of the next presidential administration, if it's not decided at that point for us to go ahead and establish the first offer permanent base on the moon, then it seems to me as though there'd almost be too little time to be able to change one's mind for a new policy to be put in place. Because if the next president would take office in January of 2017, typically it takes about a year to analyze space policy and to establish a new path. If returning to the moon with humans is not part of that picture, then basically it would either be a delay of a minimum of 4 years or perhaps 8 years, and then for the amount of time it would take to ramp up the program to actually accomplish the mission. I mean, we're talking out there in the late 2020s, really. Do you share this concern?
Not really, because we don't have to go back to the moon on a government-funded program. The Chinese, initially, they had said they were planning on going to the moon in 2023-24, but they encountered problems with their Long March rocket. That's going to be delayed by about 2 years, so that pushes all their plans to the right. Now we're looking at 25-26 at the very, very earliest, for China. The Russians, depends on whether they get this funding approved, whether the Duma does that, and that's a big if. And so we're looking at the commercial options. So if the Congress decides not to go to the moon, there's still a commercial option. So you still have Shackleton. It may be a long shot. They may get the money, they may not. If Shackleton doesn't work out, then you have Bigelow. And so that's probably, if I was going to put money on who's going to get to the moon first, I'd probably put money on Bigelow.
Do you think Bigelow has enough money to actually establish a lunar base?
The way Bigelow does it, yeah. I mean, I think he admits himself to actually establish a lunar base, he would not be able to go it alone. I mean, he was able to go it alone on Genesis, and he was almost able to go it alone on the Beam. I mean, he could have financed it himself, but he obviously has an agreement with NASA, and the ISS is really the only place to prove the technology the way he wants to prove the technology. He can certainly launch his Transats with the money that he has. He spent $220 million of his own money so far, and he intends to spend up to $500 million. So he has over $250 million in change left, and that's more than enough to establish his space stations, but probably not enough to go it alone to the moon. So if it's the case of him going to the moon, then it'd be interesting to see a collaboration between a company like Bigelow and NASA, for example.
A public-private program.
Yeah, I think that would probably be the best way it could work. That could definitely work.
Yeah, I'd agree.
The technology is there. It's just, and the technology to lift it into orbit, the only thing missing is getting it from low Earth orbit to the moon.
Well, maybe from low Earth orbit to low lunar orbit, I think maybe that could be done using, depends on the mass of the payload, but you could also use ion propulsion, but it's getting from low lunar orbit down to lunar surface. That's the last mile. I don't know either how Bigelow would do that, but if you could, I can imagine it could be one of a couple ways of sort of using Masten type of modules that you attach to the assembled lunar base, assembled in LEO and then transported, so that what happens is it you bleed off the horizontal velocity with a sort of a main engine, and then the last, the last 100 feet or so, you use the modules, not 100, but 100 meters, let's say, use the vertical modules. But another interesting possibility is to bleed off the horizontal velocity with the main engine, but then basically let the habitats be their own airbags and maybe partially deflated so that it doesn't need the horizontal, the vertical landing modules, but it basically just gets to relatively low velocity, but then just you turn off the engine and it just drops. And because it's partially deflated, doesn't bounce too much, and it sort of just settles down without popping.
Yeah, and that's mentioned in the patent. So that's how they plan to soften the blow when it lands, is to actually have them partially inflated.
Okay.
Another way they could do it is to use SpaceX, because Bigelow has an agreement with SpaceX, and that SpaceX could repurpose their Grasshopper, their retropropulsion unit, and maybe add a Grasshopper to the modules and land it that way.
Well, you could do a crasher stage, actually, where you use the Grasshopper module, or Grasshopper first stage, to get it to basic to where it's hovering, and then the stage basically drops off and crashes, leaving the inflated module to come down and bounce. But you would probably need to not have the those structural supports that lift it up off the ground, as seen in the his little models. Those would probably have to be added later, because I could imagine trying to land on those unless you have Masten type of landing modules.
Yeah, like I say, it doesn't specify what those propulsion nodes are, because so the docking nodes, those are pretty straightforward. We know what the docking nodes are. There's passive and common docking nodes, but the propulsion nodes that are mentioned in the patent, those aren't specified, so that's the unknown.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks. Good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you. Eric, all these people are planning all this technology for going to the moon, and nobody does what you suggested earlier. Nobody sells a mission, so why does anyone think that a president in 2016, whoever he or she is, or whatever party this person belongs to, is going to give a hoot about going back to the moon, given all the other problems the country is facing? And these problems are not going to go away in the 2 years between now and the presidential election. So if nobody out there is selling or making the case to go back to the moon, why does someone think, why plan all this engineering and all of this stuff? Because it's not being sold. It's not going to happen, is it?
Not the way it's sold, no. I mean, if you just say we're going to go back to the moon, then you won't get people's interest. But if you say, look, Mars via the moon, then you might get people's interest. Because as soon as you mention Mars, then people's eyes light up and you've got their attention. So you could say, well, look, It's just too dangerous right now. We can't use chemical propulsion to go to Mars because of all these bad things that can happen to the body. So we're going to go to the moon first. We're going to test the technology, and that's what they did in 100 years ago in polar exploration before they went out to the South Pole. They tested the technology, tested all the equipment.
Yeah, but
in a safer site, and a safer site is the moon.
But why
it would make sense to go to the moon, test the technology, whether it's inflatables or other types of modules or whatever, and then go from the moon to Mars.
But why would a president spend any time in his first 4 years or her first 4 years of administration planning a return to the moon when there's no selling of it, there's no pressure to do it. There's nothing but a handful of advocates yelling and screaming to go do this. Let's get real here for a moment, okay? I need some help in understanding how this is going to play out. As Doug said, you know, if he hasn't done this by the first term, this and this and this, why would he even think about this? Is this going to be a campaign issue in 2016, from what you can tell? Is there going to be an effort to wholesale sell the moon, that we need to go back there for a reason A, B, C, and D? Or is this just advocate, you know, wish list thinking here?
Matt, right now it's wishful thinking in terms of government-funded missions, because there's no impetus to go back.
Let me appoint you as the chief space advocate of the United States, okay? You're the go-to person for authentic, grounded, reality, excitement, exuberant space advocacy. You're it. Everybody knows that you're the go-to guy. The media goes to you. The staffers in Congress go to you. Everyone is going to come to Dr. Eric Seathouse for this. How do you get them interested between 2016 and 2018 to have a lunar base established on the moon as most likely a public-private type of partnership, which would probably be the most the best of financial way to go do that? How do you sell that? How do you make that come to reality? You're the go-to guy.
Yes, scaremongering. You have to play the Russian card and the Chinese card, and you have to scare people into getting them on board. So you have to say, look, these are the Chinese plans, these are the Russian plans. If we don't get there soon and reestablish our presence, then they're going to use this for all sorts of nefarious purposes. And that isn't just spin doctoring, because there's a Chinese general who is actually on record as saying they're going back to the moon to establish a military base. So there is some substance to that argument. So the scaremongering could work if they were so inclined. But like I say, the situation in China and the situation in Russia would probably have to escalate a little bit more before it became a viable proposition to actually go down that road.
What would cause the American people to actually care about this?
Well, say the Chinese land on the moon in 2024, they wander over to Tranquility Base, they pick up the American flag, they bring it back, and they present it in the Chinese museum. So now, if you want to see the Apollo 11 flag, you have to go fly over to Beijing and pay some Chinese yen and go into the museum to see the flag that Neil Armstrong planted. Maybe that would get their attention.
That should do it. That should piss a lot of people off.
Yeah, well, that may happen.
Maybe some congressmen would even unite with one another in their anger, but they'd probably plan a mission with the special forces to go steal the flag back rather than go to the moon.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Oh well. Anyway, do you put anything about a potential space race? I know the answer to this because I've read the book, but in terms of for the listeners, about a Chinese-Russian impact on a potential space race, is that part of your Bigelow book? Is Bigelow aware or cognizant of anything like that?
Bigelow is, yeah. I mean, if you've seen his ISBTS talks, especially the last one, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, he uses scaremongering as a tactic, and he uses the Chinese card all the time.
Bigelow
does. That's why he wants this amendment to the Outer Space Treaty, because he knows the Chinese will go there anyway. They won't wait around for the UN to change the Outer Space
Treaty. Whoa, what amendment is Bigelow talking about for the Outer Space Treaty?
He wants private citizens to have the right to own sections of the moon.
Oh, okay.
Right now, you can't have that in the Outer Space Treaty. That's not allowed. And, of course, the Chinese have said openly that they want to go to the moon, and they want to mine the moon for helium-3, and that means they're going to establish rights on the moon. So they're going to land there, and they're going to establish permanent commercial facilities and have property rights. And that's not allowed in the Outer Space Treaty. But do we really believe the Chinese are going to follow through on the Outer Space Treaty?
Well, they signed it, and they do keep their treaties.
Yeah, and they can withdraw from it any time.
Okay, you have another email. This is a rare day, Eric, for me with identifying listeners as with nicknames. So the Debbie Downer of space law, Michael Listener, has chimed in again. Michael, forgive me. I just can't resist it today. Maybe it's because Thanksgiving is around the corner, and I had to cancel the show Friday for everyone going to Walmart for Black Friday. Anyway, Debbie Downer, Mike Listener, the space lawyer, says the government may not be required to go back to the moon, but commercial entities will need the government's permission to do so, which will depend on space policy. Of course, Michael is 100% right. I shouldn't kid him about being the Debbie Downer of space law. But, you know, that depending on what we're doing and who's in office and who's in Congress and what the tensions and the pressures are around the world, that permission may not be there.
I'd like to query that, because what if a commercial entity launches from Russia or launches from another country? Is that
they can't do it if they're
you look at the Outer Space Treaty, then all you're looking at is Article 6. Article 6 just covers non-governmental entities operating within their jurisdiction.
Okay, but Eric, for a U.S. citizen or a launch rocket or anything that has U.S. parts in it, it needs a U.S. launch license no matter where it launches in the world. So if the policy is crappy and says no, and God help us if it is a policy like that, then you would be prevented, at least an American citizen or resident, or a rocket with U.S. parts in it would be prevented from launching in another part of the world. Our law on that has a long, long, obnoxious reach.
That's a shame.
There's a lot of things in policy that are a shame. Michael, I hope I haven't peed you off too much by referring to you as the Debbie Downer of space law, but you're 100% right on this. Let's just hope that we don't have insane politicians making insane space policy and that they would deny private permission to launch a rocket. And I can't really foresee that happening, but stranger things have happened in this world, so who knows? You have another book coming up.
Yeah, so the Virgin Galactic had to make a few changes to that after the tragic accident, but that comes out in January, maybe early February.
So you're updating it already?
Well, I had to because of the accident.
What are you saying? I mean, you won't have the NTSB report by then.
No, but they have a pretty good idea that it's probably pilot error, and it's the accident in itself that really drew the attention. So basically, it was just amending a few paragraphs here and there just to make it consistent with the outcome of the accident, and just basically saying, look, this happened in aviation, and it's a tragic event, but basically it's just a speed bump on the way to commercialization.
Well, how do you know it's pilot error and that the hybrid didn't still vibrate and the vibration shook that switch loose and caused that feather to be prematurely deployed? So everybody assumes pilot error, but remember, they've been having enormous vibration problems with their hybrid, which is why they're changing their fuel. And this was their first flight with that. So how do we know the vibration didn't cause it? That's why I'm wondering why people are not waiting for the NTSB report, although they say it'll take a year, which seems a long time.
Yeah, no, like I didn't make any shoot from the hip theories, and I didn't make any assumptions. I just said, look, based on the latest, based on the most immediate information that we have, it looked like pilot error. I mean, I didn't say it was pilot error. I did say, you know, it will take them probably a year to get the NTSB report out, and then we'll see what...
Well, then you'll have version 3 maybe coming out. you'll amend the book again when the NTSB comes out, and you'll get to have version 3. How about that?
Well, this is the first version. I mean, it hasn't been published. It wasn't published at that point. It was still in pre-production.
So it'll be version 2 then.
Yeah, and actually Virgin Galactic took all their books off Amazon after the accident.
They did what?
Their books. They were going to be publishing a whole series of books on the same day as my book.
And they pulled them all.
They pulled them all off now.
Oh, we didn't hear about that.
Not very quiet.
But then you have an Ad Astra book coming out, right?
Well, it's, in sequence, it's Virgin Galactic January/February, and then there's Survival and Sacrifice, which is about looking at the. How polar explorers explored and how Mars explorers will explore, and the difference, how they're very much the same. So that comes out probably in March, April. And then after that, Mastronaut, which is genetically engineering astronauts that can survive on Mars, because as we know, if you go by chemical propulsion, you'll just end up in a body bag. And then Vazimir will come out probably in the summer. And then going through the contract for X-Core. So I'll be writing a book about X-Core, which hopefully aligns with the test flights that start in July next year.
Is X-Corps working with you on the book, or this is on your own again?
No, no, this is approved. I interviewed Jeff Creason, who's the CEO of X-Corps. I interviewed him 2 weeks ago. I mean, I worked with X-Corps through ARET in the United States. So I actually work in the line of payload integration, so I do the payload integration for Canada through ARET, which is a company that has an agreement with X-Corps. So Kaki Rodway and Jeff Creason, they're on board, so I had access to what they're doing. I get updates from Rick Searfoss through Steve Heck, who I work with. So I have access to what the test pilots are doing and actually what they're doing in terms of building the spaceship.
I have a couple of emails. So Paul is in Denver, Colorado, and he says, I don't understand this continued obsession with a handful of listeners on the space show to going to the moon, and it sounds like you're also obsessed, Eric, with going to the moon. We've been to the moon. I understand there's probably value in going back to the moon. Why do we have to obsess on returning to the moon rather than doing something different, maybe an asteroid mission if it could be made interesting, or maybe even a Mars mission or a mission to one of the moons of Mars, which we know would be easier than going to Mars? Why are so many people obsessed with going back to the moon?
Right. First of all, it's not an obsession. I'm as big a Mars fan as anybody else, and I want to go to Mars. But there's a point where realism kicks in, and sometimes you have to play the waiting game, and playing the waiting game is waiting for a faster propulsion system, because if you go to Mars, it's all going to be in the next book about all the terrible, terrible, terrible things that are going to happen to the body, and there's more research coming out every single day about just how bad the body is affected. We're talking cataracts. So you're going to get cataracts on the way to Mars. You're going to go solid blind as a result of visually induced intracranial pressure. You're going to lose bone. You're going to lose a lot of bone. You're going to lose muscle mass. You're going to suffer from early onset Alzheimer's. I mean, by the time you get to Mars using chemical propulsion, it's not going to be a good scenario. And you may say, well, we have astronauts that go up to the International Space Station for 6 months and they're fine. Well, they're not, because you look at the Soyuz when they come back down. They're carried away on couches. They're not allowed to drive for three weeks for Christ's sake, because they have orthostatic intolerance. And their muscles are atrophied away. And then they have to, so imagine going for 6 months and then having to do a one-year mission on the surface. It's not going to happen. It is not going to happen, and the medical research is there. So sometimes when we want to go where we want to go, we sometimes have to stop off on the way, and stopping off on the way in this case is going to the moon. We get to test the technology, and while we're testing the technology and ruggedizing it and making sure that we can survive on Mars, then by the time we've done that, then the faster propulsion system will be ready to go. And chances are that will probably be Vladimir, which is going to get us there in a lot less time. So people who make the comparison between an International Space Station and going to Mars, they just don't understand the radiation environment. In ISS, you're protected because you're still within a lot of the atmosphere, so you're protected from the worst of radiation. Once you're out in deep space, you don't have that protection. You have all sorts of nasty radiation hitting you, and it's not like you can take a surgical suite along with you. You have very, very limited surgical or very, very limited medical supplies. So if somebody does get radiation sickness or something terrible happens, then you basically put them in a body bag and flush them out of an airlock. So you can't go to Mars safely using chemical propulsion, so that's why we go back to the moon.
Does that mean Mars 1 is not going to go safely or not going to go at all?
They're not going to go safely. I saw a recent article that was published based on the life support system. They expect the first death to occur within 60 days.
Yeah, they're back on my show, by the way, tomorrow. That's the MIT study with those students.
Oh, you got those, have you?
I've already had them on once. They did a full hour on the John Batchelor Show Hotel Mars segment with me for October 15th. But they're back tomorrow, the entire team, and this time they're going to talk to the listeners and take email questions and phone calls. So all of you out there who want to really nail them to the wall for their heresy against Mars One, for those of you that are the true believers here, they're available, and they'll take the heat. They're in the frying pan tomorrow night for the full show. So I've got four of the team members. The only one who's not with us is their professor. Who won't be with us, but the team members who wrote the report are all there.
Yeah, having said that, I still support Mars One, because 100 years ago, when Nansen, Shackleton, Amundsen, and all these famous explorers, when they left the dock, They understood very clearly that it was probably a one-way mission, but they weren't coming back.
Okay, so Lunar Doug has responded to my questioning what another president might do down the road. And I guess he's responding to your comments, too, since you and I sort of agreed with one another. So here is what Lunar Doug has to say. During Obama's first presidential campaign, space wasn't an issue, and Obama may not have cared about anything to do with space. In that respect, things are the same now as they were before. Back then, Mike Listener is attacking me now for Debbie Downer of Space Law. I'll read that one in a minute. Back then, the economy seemed worse than it was now, fiscal cliff and all. Yet, as President Obama and all other presidents feel compelled to review space policy and make it their own. So for this reason alone, there is the possibility of a change in policy direction. Sure, there's no guarantee the next president will choose a better direction, but at least there is a possibility of a chance in policy change, which is more that how it's been for the last few years of status quo. So how might a new president view the current space policy? It is not a stretch to say there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that feel that the current direction is floundering. But how to politically improve the direction? The political solution could be to keep Mars in the picture by either saying to Mars via the moon or to say to the moon and Mars simultaneously, starting with a Mars flyby. But it is the moon that could be tempting to the next president, but only if it could be afforded within the current budget, meaning that it would have to be done cheaply, and that means a Kotz-like approach. So do you want to comment on that or just let it stand?
Well, no. I mean, what did you say about Obama? He did get one thing right, and that was to push the commercialization of space. I mean, that's been a good thing, no matter how you look at it. In terms of the Moon-Mars situation, again, we haven't got a propulsion system that gets us there quickly. So it would just be irresponsible to send anybody on a chemical propulsion voyage right now. So why not go back to the moon and test the technology there?
I mean, even Elon is talking about using one of his larger Falcon Heavy-type rockets and a souped-up Red Dragon to go to Mars. He's not talking about nuclear propulsion.
Yeah, and he's not going to the moon either. He just wants to get to Mars as quickly as possible. So, it's risky. And as I say, every day more and more research comes out just saying just how bad that mission is going to be for anybody who wants to risk it.
Okay, Michael Listener, the space lawyer, my good friend, hopefully he's still my good friend, has responded to being labeled the Debbie Downer of space law. And he says, Debbie Downer, with a question mark, the realist. You know, I don't know the history of Debbie Downer as a term, so I don't know if Debbie Downer was a realist or just a negative whatever or just a joke name. I don't even know if there is really a Debbie Downer for real. There's a thin line, Michael and listeners, and by the way, I deal with this maybe 10 times a week as I get emails from people saying, David, you're so negative. There is a very thin line between being negative and being realistic. And I think the difference between it is that the realist has hope that you can actually do what it is you're being accused of being negative about, although how you go about it may be very different than what a lot of other people are talking about, which is why you get accused of being negative. I think someone who's just negative would say, you got to kill space tourism, you know, like all those articles that came out after the Virgin accident. We can't have private people flying in space. It's too dangerous, too risky. That's the negative. The realist might be very critical of what Virgin is doing, for example, but absolutely is committed to and believes in the potential for space tourism. So I understand it's a thin line, and Michael, I don't know if Debbie Downer, which side of that thin line she is on, but it's your name, my friend. What else is in the Bigelow book that we should know about it? Because it really is a very, very good book, and it's a timeline of Bigelow and his work and his projects pretty much from his beginning all the way up to current times.
Yeah, and that's probably the chapter that might grab people's attention is the first one because of his UFO interest. So he has a pretty interesting background in terms of UFO, because if you happen to spot a UFO, you actually report it to Bigelow, not to the FAA. So Bigelow is actually, the Bigelow Aerospace Group is actually responsible for reporting UFOs to the United States.
When, first of all, he has been on, when Art, he is really good friends with Art Bell. And when Art Bell was doing his nightly show before he retired, he was on Art's show a lot, and he had a ranch, which they wouldn't ever say where the ranch was, where there were supposed to be lots and lots of UFO sightings. And Bob has written a book, which you can probably still find on Amazon, about UFO and sighting. He is a believer. And when I did my little tour of Bigelow with other people from the Space Frontier Foundation, what was really funny is all of the models, you know, for the Genesis space stations that were, they were inflated models, as I said, that, you know, they're scaled, but they were bigger than a person, and they, you know, they were on pedestals and things like that. All of them in the windows, in the little portals, he put little alien figures, grays, in the windows of each one of them. So the grays were looking out at us from inside the module. You know, just little tiny, you know, figurines that you'd get at a toy store of the aliens looking out. So that is an interest of his, and he doesn't usually mix it with space. You know, he keeps it separate from what I understand. The times I've talked to him, I've never asked him about his alien interest.
But, well, if you go to the Bigelow compound, it's guarded by military types.
Yeah.
And on their uniforms, they actually have alien logos.
Yeah, they have. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
Well, I like that community, too. I've got alien logos on my cell phone and my car, so whatever, I guess. Is Bigelow controversial, in your opinion, to Congress or others? I mean, you know, Elon can be controversial, and he's got a couple of lawsuits going with the Air Force, and then one with Bezos over the patent of landing reusable craft on a barge. So, you know, Elon can fight, and, you know, so what about Bigelow? Is he confrontational? Is he in such a different line of space work that these things don't come up and affect him?
Well, he's in a unique position because he's not involved in the launcher, so he's involved in the destination. So that's what he's all about. And he's not really controversial. If he is, it's controversial in a good sense, and he actually gets people to think about things like the Chinese threat, for example. So, you know, the scaremongering, I guess you could call that controversial. But, like, it serves a purpose. It gets people to think, and, you know, it creates talk and gets people to, you know, think about how we're going to get back to the moon and how we're going to actually do this via the commercial route. So he hasn't been tainted by any lawsuits from what I gathered in the research I did for the book. And I'd say pretty much every step has been the right one. And he's going in the direction he wants to go. And I think he's going to get there very soon.
You have another email, and this may be the last one for the day. So George is in Atlanta. And George says, I have heard many listeners as well as guests on David's show over the past year who absolutely refute that there is anything close to a space race or a threat from China. And they absolutely claim that anyone who says that is hysterical, warmongering, and doesn't understand Chinese policy. What do you have to say about that? How do you know that China is a threat to us? How does Bigelow know that?
Well, he doesn't, but he uses that argument to effect, because he's in the business of selling his lunar base, and he wants to get to the moon.
So So this is marketing, is what you're telling me.
Well, part of it's marketing, but there's no smoke without fire. I mean, like I said earlier in the show, there is a PLA general on record saying that the Chinese want to go back to the moon to establish a military base. And if people are fine with the Chinese establishing a military base, fine. If that doesn't constitute friction in terms of a space war, then there's no space war. But in most people's minds, the Chinese military establishing a military base on the moon would would probably cause a few problems.
So what about you? Because you've talked about the China stuff before. Are you really convinced that China is some sort of a threat to us, or is it marketing with you?
I don't think there's a threat. I think unless you perceive them establishing property rights on the moon as a threat, because that's probably what they're going to do. I mean, that's what they have stated their intention of going back to the moon, establishing a manned base and mining helium-3. And they intend to do that by establishing property rights, which again is against the Outer Space Treaty.
Well, no, they'll just go do it and they'll say, you know, go stop us, right?
Yeah, so when they do that, which I'm sure they will, then if that is perceived as a threat, then it's a threat. That's the only threat I see. I mean, I don't see any nefarious purposes in terms of establishing a military base. Not sure if that was just rhetoric or whether that was just scaremongering on the Chinese part, but I really don't see they have the resources to establish a military base right now.
Well, you know, if it prompts us to actually get off our duffs and have a decent space policy and lunar policy, then maybe China pushing something like that would be good in the long run.
Well, I think it's going to take them a good few years yet before they're able to do that. Their budget is very small compared to the American budget. I mean, you look at their entire military budget, it's dwarfed by the American military budget. And, of course, the Chinese space program is a military space program because it's owned by the PLA, or it's run by the PLA, rather.
Right, and their Long March is their heavy lift rocket that they really need for all of this stuff. And as you said, it's got some delays going on with it. So, what should we have talked about or mentioned about your book that we've forgotten, that I've forgotten, or that you still want to tell us?
Well, just we didn't much talk about Bigelow himself, and I'm not sure if people would be interested in that, the Skinwalker Ranch and the UFO connection. But that's pretty much where he got his interest in space, was when he saw his first UFO, I think, or his grandparents saw a UFO. And as far as I understand it, that was a catalyst for him taking an interest in space. And then he went on to be involved in the Skinwalker Ranch. He bought that because that's where the UFOs are supposed to visit. And that's the connection with the FAA. So the FAA now, according to the FAA directive, UFOs are now reported through Bigelow Aerospace.
That's, I think, the name of his book that I mentioned that he wrote about this. That's, I think, you can still probably get on Amazon.
I think it's called Skinwalker Ranch. Yeah,
the Skinwalker Ranch. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, Eric. Until the next time. Are you frustrated that we're not making? I mean, it seems to all of us, most of us who listen to the show, even if we disagree on methodology, we all want to do something. Does it seem really frustrating and slow going to you, much slower than it needs to be?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does.
Is space at all an issue of intensity with most people in Canada, or is it, hardly ever talked about? Or in the United States, it's probably got a broader constituency, I would imagine, right?
Well, it's thought about, but in a bad way now, because the latest president of the Canadian Space Agency resigned, and so we've had seven presidents in the last 9 years, and their budget has been reduced. So I think 15 years ago, the budget was $300 million for a space agency with a manned space program. Now it's at $280 million. So imagine in real terms what that is. It's less than half. It's been cut in half by the Conservative government. It's in a desperate state. And so I met David Saint-Jacques at IAC in October. He's one of our astronauts. So he was selected in 2009. And the very, very earliest, either of those guys is going to fly, it's going to be 2019, by which time they'll have been training for 10 years for a flight. And that's only one of them. So I don't know when the second guy's going to fly, but like I say, the Canadian Space Agency is in disarray right now financially. But it does a very, very good job in terms of PR. So people are very, very aware of what Canada does because the Canadian Space Agency does a very, very good PR job. So we have a lot of blue suit days, Jeremy and David, every month. They do two blue suit days each. They could be going to communities in the north and the Arctic. Could be Vancouver. Doesn't matter. They go everywhere to promote the Canadian Space Agency. So every month you have at least 2 days in front of an astronaut talking about what they do. So there's a very high level of awareness there. But in terms of flights now, Chris Hadfield was the last one for quite a while, I think.
Right, and he lives in Denver now.
He's working in London. Just down the road.
Oh, in London? Because the last time I tried to contact him for a show, it was in Denver.
Well, he should be easy to contact now because he's a professor at, I think, in the engineering department at London University.
Okay. Do you know how to...
He's a regular job now.
Do you know how to reach him?
Well, he's got London University, Ontario, and Chris Hadfield.
In Ontario, Canada?
Yeah, London, Ontario, yeah.
Okay. What's he teaching? Is he in the engineering department?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll see if I can track him down, because I'd love to have him come on the show. I think he'd be a great guest. This is probably your last email. This is Debbie Downer, Michael Listener, said, I intend to label myself as the realist in a good manner. But that's not marketing. I mean, Debbie Downer is a much better name, Michael. You got to admit. I'm not thin-skinned. I know you're not thin-skinned. But, you know, nicknames have as much to do with marketing and PR as does trying to figure out how to get us back to the moon. You actually have another phone call. Can you stay on the line, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay, hang on. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Is this Debbie Downer?
No, this is Michael Listener, not Debbie Downer. Debbie Downer. Oh,
this
come
is,
on.
Give this me is a, your alter
ego. You know what? I always tell people, you know, and I always get this a lot as a lawyer. People say, well, why do you have to always be so negative? I said, I'm not being negative. I'm just trying to show you where the potholes are so you can actually drive a safe right route and not get clobbered. And people say, no, you're being negative all the time, always assuming the worst. And I said, well, that's what I do, and that's what lawyers do. We always assume the worst, so we're prepared for it. I just wanted to clarify my email. I meant to label myself as a realist in a positive manner, as in, you know me for a few years now, David. I am really super passionate about space. My company's motto is blazing a trail into the final legal and policy frontier. But, you know, and you and I have had discussions about this offline, but, you know, a good dose of real, in order to get the job done, you can't have fandom, you can't have illusion, you got to deal with reality. And,
okay.
And that doesn't mean you can't do something. It means you got to find the right way to do something.
All right, so for everyone who doesn't know this, Debbie Downer is the name of a fictional Saturday Night Live character who debuted in 2004 and was portrayed by Rachel Dratch. The character's name, Debbie Downer, is a slang phrase which refers to someone who frequently adds bad news and negative feelings to the gathering, thus bringing down the mood of everyone around them. Dratch's character would usually appear at social gatherings and interrupt the conversation to voice negative opinions and pronouncements. Now, Michael, I have to tell you, that's what you do with your legal arguments with all the space cadets on the space show.
Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's just like,
but we love
the way
you.
It is.
We love you just the same, but it is.
Well,
I think it's going to stick. Watch and see. You'll be on the blogs as Debbie Downer now.
If I do, well, oh boy, I hope not. I'm not the nickname type of guy. That's just not. You know what? I did have one nickname that somebody gave me many years ago, and it was in karate when I studied martial arts. I won't repeat it over on the air like this. I'll tell you in private. But let's hope it doesn't stick. I really don't need that to kind of cloud my reputation out there. But, I mean, oh, well, I'll deal with it as it comes, I guess.
Do you have a question or comment for Eric with his Bigelow Aerospace work?
No, not. I mean, interesting stuff. And, you know, obviously Bigelow is really a visionary and a pioneer. I've been kind of critical of him in the past, about a few of his things. And, you know, I think one of the things I want the listeners to understand is I wasn't being critical to be mean or to denigrate his activities, but more or less to say, hey, you know, maybe he's going down the wrong path. He's got the right ideas, but, you know, he's going down the wrong path, and he needs to, you know, reconsider it. And that gets, well, that goes back into the whole, you know, well, you're being negative, yada, yada, yada. No, I'm not. I'm trying to, you know, help facilitate things so they actually work. I want to see space get utilized. I want to see commercial space succeed. But, you know, we just got to, you know, we got to do it the right way. And the right way isn't always the way we think it should be.
Lunar Doug sent in a note. Obviously, he's more thin-skinned than you. So from now on, you are Cynical Dave. Do you embrace that name, since calling people names seems to be what you are into today? Well, Doug, do you not remember that I am one of the four original space cynics with Dr. John Juris, Tom Olson, and Shubber Ali at spacecynics.com? I've tried to get that website back up and running. I've even done special shows to get it back up and even take guest posts. But for some reason, the momentum dies out with all the cynics as well as other people. And it's too bad, because I think it served a great role for two or three years where it was active. But I am one of the original space cynics of that group. So calling me cynical seems to be left over from the space cynics days. That blog, by the way, is still available, and people can go back and see the original post that we used to do on it. Maybe we'll still find a way to get the energy to resurrect it. It was a lot of fun for us, and we took a lot of issues that were based on fantasy and Kool-Aid, and we just laid the facts out, and people could do what they want to do, you know, with the information. So spacecynics.com, I think, was the website. Anything else, Michael, from you?
Well, you know, just to kind of reinforce your, you know, the accusation of, you know, your name of being a cynic, just understand that if it wasn't for a cynic during the Apollo, when they were first putting Apollo together, we would have not made it to the moon, because Wernher von Braun was extremely determined to do it his way, landing this big rocket on the moon, and there was this one guy who sat out there saying it's not going to work and suggested in-orbit rendezvous, and he hung on to it, and he aggravated a lot of people. And he was a cynic, he was a bad egg, he got reprimanded for it, but he ended up being right in the end, and we got to the moon because of him. And even von Braun admitted that to him.
Listeners, the Space Cynics blog, if any of you are new and are not familiar with it and you want to go back and see what we used to do, it's http://spacecynic, all one word, .wordpress.com. And we do take guest posts on it. They have to be approved by the original four cynics, at least three of the four of us, because we don't want to put crap up there, because it really was, despite the fun and the jests, it really was factually looking at different proposals and showing why, you know, we think they're Looney Tunes. So it wasn't just total nonsense. So we do have a quality control issue. But if somebody wants to do a guest cynics post, we're absolutely open to it, and you just need to submit it to one of the four cynics, and then we'll send it around. I think that our rule was that we need to have it approved for posting by at least three of the four of us, and the four of us are all still in touch with one another. So that's still an option, so check it out, spacecynic.wordpress.com. Michael, is that it for you?
No, I just wanted to reinforce to your guests, you know, I'm going to have one. I will have to get the book and read it on Bigelow in particular, because I'm really interested in what he's doing. But, you know, listening to what Bigelow's been doing, he's got some great ideas. I think he needs to work on his legal approach, legal and policy approach a little bit. But, you know, we need visionaries right out there. They don't always have us get it right the first time, but, you know, but if they keep an open mind, they eventually get there. Thank you for the guest being on, and like I said, I'll have to pick up the book and give it a read.
Well, he does have a legal office in Washington, D.C. Mike Gold is, and he's been on the show several times. So.
Oh, I know about that. We'll talk about that offline.
All right, and for people, if you do buy the book and you get it through Amazon, remember to use the One Giant Leap Foundation Space Show portal. Then the instructions for that are on all the archive summaries on the blog and Space Show programs on the website, because if you do that, Amazon will donate a portion of the purchase price to the Space Show, and that's very helpful, and we appreciate your thinking about that. All right, Michael, until the next time, thank you for calling.
Good night, David. Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Eric, any concluding comments, summaries, anything you want us to remember or take home about Bigelow?
No, just to echo what the what Mike just said, and that's what Bigelow's, you know, he's a pioneer, and the same way in that Wernher von Braun was. And I think in 20 or 30 years' time, when you look back at commercial spaceflight, the name is Elon Musk, and Bigelow will be mentioned in the same way that Wernher von Braun is today.
He is a visionary. I've met the guy. He's all business, and I like him very much. And I'm hoping he's very, very successful in what he does. And I think if he can get the modules up there and they perform as expected, I think that is really transformative, because then there will be a destination in space other than a government destination. And I think that will be a fabulous asset, and would be really helpful to opening up the industry. So we shall see, right?
Yeah, I think he's going to do it.
All right. You let me know when the next one's available, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, sounds good, David. Thanks again.
Okay, have a good holiday season coming up, Eric. Thanks for being on the show today. Listeners, that's it with Eric Seedhouse. Again, the book, Bigelow Aerospace, Colonizing Space One Module at a Time. The MIT team who did the analysis for life support for Mars One that has gotten a lot of press over the last 3 or 4 months is with us tomorrow night, 7 p.m. California time. The full team is with us, minus their professor from MIT. We will be taking your email questions and phone line questions. In the website newsletter and the October 15th archive, I've put the URL for how to download the Mars One analysis paper by the MIT students. If you haven't read it yet, it's an excellent paper. I suggest you read it. I would also suggest you listen to the October 15th Hotel Mars show. It's about 40 minutes long, because we did an extra segment or two with Bachelor with the group. But we will be going into much more detail tomorrow night. And as I said, the team will be taking your questions and your comments, something we don't do on Hotel Mars. So if you want to talk to them and ask them about their work or Mars One or why they did it or anything like that, they're available in force to respond with you. So again, 7 p.m. tomorrow night, California time. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Eric Seedhouse and to all of you who called in and emailed in and participated in today's show. If you don't listen to any more shows this week, have a very happy Thanksgiving holiday this week. Keep it safe and enjoy your time together with your friends and family. Goodbye, everyone, from the Space Show.